Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a focused exploration of the Washington Post for Saturday, August 23rd, 2025. Our mission is to swiftly extract the most impactful insights and surprising facts, giving you a clear shortcut to being well-informed without the overwhelming flood of information. I'm Lee Graham, your guide through today's vital headlines.
And I'm Sam Hurst. I'm here to connect the dots and zoom out, helping you understand not just what happened, but well, why it truly matters. We'll link seemingly separate events to the larger forces shaping our world, encouraging you, to think critically about the news.
Okay, let's jump right into the heart of domestic politics, where executive power is undeniably making its mark. We begin with a look at some pretty significant federal investigations and ongoing legal battles. All right, our top story is a real headline grabber: the FBI search of John Bolton's Washington area home and office on Friday. The focus seems to be on whether the former Trump national security advisor illegally possessed or shared classified information.
And it's not just about his book anymore, right? The allegations now extend beyond that 2020 book.
Exactly. The Post says it extends to other more long-running accusations of leaking sensitive materials,
which broadens the scope considerably.
It does. And what's striking is the public display this created flashing lights, police cars blocking the street, TV cameras.
Even protesters showed up, I read, with signs like, "Trump uses FBI for vengeance."
Right. And this was despite Bolton not being home and, importantly, no charges being filed yet.
Yeah, this isn't just a quiet legal move. It's a very public spectacle. And that immediately fuels the whole weaponization debate.
You mean like Bolton's neighbor, Gerald Rogel, who questioned if this was the DOJ being used for, quote, personal reasons?
Precisely. Critics jump on that narrative, arguing it looks like political retribution.
Mm.
On the other side, the administration claims it's strictly about upholding national security, protecting classified information,
which is a standard non-disclosure agreement requirement,
right?
Handling classified info properly.
Absolutely. There are strict rules and legal processes, including getting search warrants in cases like these. But the optics here are powerful,
especially with President Trump's reaction. He denied knowing beforehand, but then quickly called Bolton a real sort of a lowlife and a very unpatriotic guy.
And he referenced his own experience with the Mar-a-Lago raid, didn't he? Almost drawing a parallel.
He did. And then he added that comment about being actually the chief law enforcement officer, implying he could have initiated it, but didn't.
Which, plays right into that ongoing narrative about executive power and how it's wielded. It keeps that debate front and center.
Meanwhile, Bolton's stance, through his attorney, has been firm. He emphatically rejects any claim that he acted improperly and said he'd cooperate.
Though a federal judge did previously rule, regarding the book, that Bolton likely jeopardized national security interests, even while allowing publication.
And Bolton himself called the administration a retribution presidency just earlier this month, so the battle lines were already drawn.
It's also interesting timing. Even as agents were there, Bolton posted criticism of Trump's engagement with Putin over Ukraine, though who knows if that was pre-scheduled.
Right. So the key takeaway seems to be how these visible actions, combined with the political commentary, really impact public trust in federal law enforcement. It just deepens the polarization.
Exactly. It becomes less about the specific legal merits, perhaps, and more about which side you believe is weaponizing the system. It's a tough spot for public confidence.
Okay. From one high-profile figure to another, let's talk about Ghislaine Maxwell's testimony. Jeffrey Epstein's associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, recently told the Justice Department she never saw President Trump act improperly.
This was during an interview, not sworn court testimony, right? In Tallahassee.
Correct. An interview. And she didn't just deny seeing impropriety. She suggested Trump got swept into some of this unnecessarily because of, quote, animus, calling it deeply offensive.
So she's actively defending him in a way. Did she offer anything on others, like Bill Clinton?
No. The article says she offered no incriminating testimony about others. Regarding Clinton, she said she actually had a closer relationship with him than Epstein did and never saw Clinton receive massages or even visit Epstein's properties.
Just described him as just a rich guy with a plane.
That's the quote. And she explicitly denied the existence of any Epstein client list or knowledge of blackmail, calling talk of it ludicrous.
Mm. And she also weighed in on Epstein's death.
She did. Expressed skepticism about the official suicide finding, believing he was murdered by another inmate. But she dismissed conspiracy theories about powerful people killing him in jail,
arguing they had opportunities when he wasn't incarcerated.
Right. Now, the context for this interview is important. It happened as the Trump administration was facing, well, a lot of heat and online theories about its handling of the Epstein investigation.
Especially after reneging on promises to disclose more files and Attorney General Pam Bondi's earlier comments about an Epstein client list.
Exactly. So what's the legal weight here? What does this interview actually mean?
Well, legally, an interview from a convicted individual like Maxwell carries limited weight compared to, say, sworn testimony or corroborated evidence. It's essentially her statement, but in the court of public opinion, that's different. Her words will definitely be interpreted through existing political lenses.
So some might see it as clearing Trump's name or at least casting doubt on his involvement?
Not possibly. Supporters might point to it as exoneration, but critics could easily dismiss it as self-serving or part of a larger effort to protect powerful people, maybe even politically motivated given the timing.
Especially given the administration's previous stance on releasing information.
Right. It feeds into that enduring Epstein shadow. Does her statement change the narrative? Probably not drastically. It likely just reinforces whatever people already believed about Epstein's network, Trump's involvement, or potential cover-ups. It adds another layer to the intrigue, but doesn't necessarily provide clarity.
Okay, let's shift to another major legal development, this one a significant win for President Trump. The headline focuses on selective prosecution and a warning against lawfare. Essentially, a New York appellate panel threw out that huge $465 million fine imposed against Trump back in 2024.
The one related to the fraud case brought by NY Attorney General Letitia James.
That's the one. The panel ruled it violated the Constitution's ban on excessive fines, but it wasn't a unified decision.
How so?
Well, the five judges were divided. Some would have kept the fraud finding but voided the fine. Others wanted a whole new trial citing serious errors, and one judge would have just dismissed the case entirely.
So quite a split. That highlights the complexity. The ruling centers on that excessive fines clause, right?
Yeah.
Which is meant to prevent punishments that are grossly disproportionate.
Yes. And the editorial commentary mentioned in the Post piece really leans into the idea that the case itself was unusual, calling it novel and even concocted by Letitia James, who, as you mentioned, campaigned on going after Trump.
The argument being that aggressive accounting is common in real estate. And the banks involved didn't sue or actually lose money. That raises the question of prosecutorial discretion.
And whether this specific case was politically motivated from the start.
That's the core of the selective enforcement argument. Judge David Friedman, who was sympathetic to Trump, specifically warned the case amounted to retaliation for Trump's First Amendment rights, basically his political activities.
But the article also connects this to what it calls the Trump administration's own escalating lawfare campaign.
Ah, so turning the tables. Like the accusations of mortgage fraud against James herself and Senator Adam Schiff and Fed Governor Lisa Cook.
Exactly. It even mentions a Justice Department official, Ed Martin, showing up outside James's home.
Wow. So the bigger picture here is this concept of lawfare, using the legal system as a weapon against political opponents.
And the danger it poses, right, whether it's state actors like James or federal actors within the Trump administration, the perception that the justice system is being weaponized erodes public trust.
Fundamentally, it undermines the idea of impartial justice and can be really damaging to democratic processes. People start seeing courts not as neutral arbiters, but as political battlegrounds.
So does the administration celebrating this ruling while using similar tactics against others look inconsistent or hypocritical?
That's the question the article implicitly raises. It creates this cycle where both sides accuse the other of weaponizing the law, and ultimately, faith in the legal system itself suffers. It's a concerning trend, this blurring of lines between legal due process and political strategy. #tag tag 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 B, federal state clashes, and the culture wars.
All right, let's broaden our view now to these intense clashes emerging between the federal government and state governments, often really fueled by the culture wars. First up, California's redistricting battle. The headline reads, Newsom's Trump-centered map fight comes with peril. California Governor Gavin Newsom is openly pushing a ballot measure to redraw congressional maps, positioning it as a direct challenge to President Trump.
So this isn't subtle. He's making it about Trump. What does the measure actually do?
It would temporarily suspend the state's nonpartisan redistricting commission. The goal is to create five additional Democratic-leaning districts for the 2026, 2028, and 2030 elections.
Temporarily suspend.
Yeah.
So the independent commission comes back later.
Yes, in 2031. But here's the catch. This only happens if Texas or another state makes similar partisan changes to their maps first. It's conditional.
Ah, so it's like preemptive retaliation or setting the stage for a tit-for-tat on gerrymandering. That's bold.
The article calls it a high-risk, high-reward proposition for Newsom, especially given his potential 2028 presidential ambitions.
Makes sense. If it passes and works, it's a tangible blow to Trump and boosts Newsom's profile as a fighter. But if it fails,
it could seriously jeopardize his national standing. Public opinion seems divided. A Berkeley poll showed 48% support, 32% oppose, and 20% undecided among registered voters.
So it's not a sure thing, and this is part of a bigger feud between Newsom and Trump.
Absolutely. The article lists ongoing clashes over the National Guard, immigration, wildfires, tariffs, university funding. It's intense. Trump's been hitting Newsom on Truth Social, calling him Gavin Newsom.
Though some Republicans apparently question if attacking Newsom in deep blue California is even effective for Trump.
Meanwhile, Newsom's team is playing offense online, too, with aggressive tactics like tweeting, "Today we will make the maps great again."
Wow. So this really puts the spotlight on redistricting itself. You have independent commissions designed to prevent partisan gerrymandering versus these overt political power plays.
And the impact of congressional maps on who controls Congress is huge.
Absolutely. So this California fight, while local, becomes a kind of national bellwether. It's a proxy battle reflecting the national political polarization and could signal where things are headed with gerrymandering across the country.
It's a major strategic gamble for Newsom. We'll have to watch how it plays out for his political future.
Okay, next up, another federal-state clash, this time squarely in the culture war arena. HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, is pulling $12 million from California's pregnancy prevention program.
Right, a move the Post describes as a culture war escalation. The Trump administration revoked the grants for California's Personal Responsibility Education Program, or PREPREP, the accusation, that the state was promoting gender ideology in its curriculum.
And California's response?
They refuse to remove the gender-related content. They maintain the materials are medically accurate, comprehensive, and age-appropriate, and, importantly, were previously determined to comply with federal statute.
So they're standing their ground based on prior approval and medical accuracy.
Right.
What does this PREPREP program actually do?
It serves about 12,000 young people aged 10 to 19 each year, and it focuses on high-need groups, homeless youth, kids of migrant farm workers, those in foster care, or the juvenile justice system.
And the education covers things like abstinence, contraception, healthy relationships, adolescent development, standard comprehensive sex ed topics.
Exactly. But the Trump administration has been targeting Democratic states over gender identity education and transgender athletes pretty aggressively.
And HHS Secretary Gratison's quote was quite stark. "The Trump administration will not allow taxpayer dollars to be used to indoctrinate children. Accountability is coming."
For every state that uses federal funds to teach children delusional gender ideology, yes, very strong language. And the White House is apparently reviewing other federal funds going to California as well.
This really highlights the tension over federal grants. How much control does the federal government have over state programs funded by those grants, especially regarding curriculum? It tests the limits of state autonomy.
And it's clearly an escalation, using funding as leverage to impose a specific ideological viewpoint on states.
The most immediate impact, though, is on those 12,000 kids, particularly the vulnerable ones in high-need categories.
Losing access to comprehensive sexual health education could have real consequences for them.
It sets a worrying precedent for federal intervention in state education based on cultural or ideological disagreements, potentially harming the very populations these programs are designed to help.
Okay, let's head south to Florida now, where environmentalism is clashing hard with immigration policy. A federal judge has ordered Florida to dismantle Alligator Alcatraz.
Alligator Alcatraz. That's the nickname for the immigrant detention facility built in the Everglades, right?
That's the one. The judge ordered it closed, citing illegal construction specifically, building it without the required environmental assessment, and also causing irreparable harm to the Everglades habitat.
What was this place actually like? The article mentions trailers and tents on an old airstrip.
Yes, intended for the, quote, most vicious migrants. And President Trump had made that comment, maybe humorous, maybe chilling, about how we're going to teach them how to run away from an alligator. It held about 1,000 people at its peak.
So the environmental harm was the key factor in the ruling.
Absolutely. The judge emphasized considerable environmental impacts and irreparable harm. Mentioned endangered species like the Florida panther, wood storks, the bonneted bat.
And the physical damage. Paving wetlands.
Yes. State contractors apparently paved over 20 acres of adjacent wetlands. Plus, the security lighting was so bright it disrupted a Dark Sky International location visible for miles. And pollution was threatening the Miccosukee tribe's water supply.
So this invokes NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the whole point of environmental impact assessments before major projects.
Exactly. The lawsuit was brought by environmentalists and the Miccosukee tribe under NEPA.
And how did Florida react to the ruling?
Governor Ron DeSantis called it a disruption, but was defiant, said this is not going to deter us, and he immediately announced plans for a new immigrant detention site converting an old prison in North Florida.
Giving it the name Deportation Depot.
Right, and the cost is notable. $6 million for the new site compared to a staggering $450 million spent on alligator Alcatraz.
Wow. And the attorney general's office called the judge an activist judge.
Standard response. So this really puts the clash in focus. Aggressive immigration enforcement versus environmental regulations and indigenous rights.
It's a stark balancing act, or perhaps a lack of balance. The state seems willing to prioritize the enforcement goal despite significant environmental damage and legal challenges.
And the financial cost is huge, too. $450 million for a facility now ordered dismantled, only to spend millions more on a new one. It really shows the lengths the state is willing to go to pursue this particular policy, regardless of the environmental or fiscal consequences.
Still in Florida, another symbolic clash. Florida paints a repulsed rainbow crosswalk without warning.
Yeah, this one hit hard for many. Florida's transportation department just painted over a rainbow crosswalk right outside the Pulse nightclub in Orlando.
The one honoring the victims of the 2016 mass shooting there.
Exactly. And the timing wasn't accidental. It followed directives from both Governor DeSantis and President Trump to remove social, political, or ideological messages from state-maintained roads and sidewalks.
So a direct application of that policy. How did the community react?
Strong condemnation. State Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith and Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer called it depraved and a cruel political act. They stressed that no warning was given. Apparently, other non-rainbow-colored crosswalks were painted over, too.
Yeah, so the justification from the state was just compliance.
Pretty much. The department said it was correcting pavement markings not in compliance. They also noted local efforts to build a permanent memorial nearby. DeSantis echoed the sentiment, saying, "We will not allow our state roads to be commandeered for political purposes."
This ties into a broader pattern, doesn't it? The article mentioned the removal of a Black Lives Matter street mural in D.C.
It does. It seems like part of a trend of erasing certain symbols from public spaces. But the community response was immediate.
People gathered with chalk.
Yes, spontaneously, to temporarily recolor the asphalt. And a rally was held at the site.
This really raises questions about public art, symbols, and who controls public spaces. What's the legal framework there?
It's complex, but governments generally have significant control over state-maintained property. But the implications of actively removing memorials and symbols are profound.
Especially symbols associated with specific identity groups or tragedies like the Pulse shooting. It impacts community memory, collective grief, and freedom of expression.
And it forces that question. Is a memorial for victims of a targeted hate crime inherently political? Or does labeling it that way serve to diminish its purpose and erase a painful history?
It's a powerful example of the politics of memory and how symbolic acts by the government can be deeply felt by communities, becoming flashpoints in the culture wars. ####, see federal institutions under pressure.
Okay, let's shift focus now to the federal institutions themselves. They seem to be under, well, considerable pressure and facing some significant challenges. First, let's look at the Federal Reserve's dilemma. Fed Chair Jerome Powell gave his final keynote at the Jackson Hole Conference.
Right, and the core message seemed a bit mixed.
Exactly. He said a slowing job market may warrant future interest rate cuts, which the market liked. Stocks rallied. The Dow hit a record high.
But there's always a but with the Fed these days.
Right. But he also warned that President Trump's trade policies still pose a threat of higher inflation.
So the classic Fed tightrope walk, trying to balance their dual mandate, maximum employment, and price stability.
And he mentioned the neutral rate where policy isn't stimulating or restricting might actually be higher now than before the pandemic due to changes in productivity, demographics, fiscal policy.
Which complicates things further. And amidst all this economic signaling, he also seemed to defend the Fed's independence, didn't he?
Subtly, yes. He stated decisions would be based solely on incoming data and they would never deviate from that approach, which sounds like a direct response to
President Trump's constant calls for rate cuts, his threats to remove Powell, and more recently, the calls for Fed Governor Lisa Cook's resignation.
Yes. So Powell's trying to reassure markets and the public that the Fed won't bow to political pressure, which is historically crucial for its credibility.
But that pressure is undeniable. And not everyone at the Fed agrees on cuts. The Cleveland Fed president, Bev Hammack, apparently doesn't see the case yet. Their next meeting is mid-September.
And Powell directly linked Trump's policies to inflation, noting, "The effects of tariffs on consumer prices are now clearly visible and likely to accumulate."
So you have this challenging economic picture, a softer job market, but ongoing inflation risks, partly fueled by administration policy, combined with intense political pressure on the Fed's independence. It's a really difficult spot for Powell as his term nears its end.
And speaking of that pressure on the Fed, the situation with Governor Lisa Cook is escalating. Trump threatens to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook if she does not resign.
A public threat to fire a Fed governor. That's unprecedented, isn't it?
Highly unusual, yes. The context is these allegations of mortgage fraud against Cook. Trump is publicly demanding she resign or face termination.
But Cook has a long term, confirmed by the Senate until 2038. And the law says a president can only fire a Fed governor for cause-like misconduct. Has any president ever actually tried it?
No president has ever attempted this. It would likely lead to a major legal battle over executive power and the independence of agencies like the Fed.
And the allegations themselves, where are they coming from?
The Federal Housing Finance Agency, or FHFA, accused her of mortgage fraud. The FHFA director, Bill Pult, posted what the article calls unsubstantiated allegations on X, questioning inconsistencies in her property declaration.
And Cook's response?
She's defiant. Stated she has no intention of being bullied to step down and will provide facts to answer legitimate questions.
This ties back to that lawfare theme, doesn't it? The article connects this threat to the administration's strategy of using mortgage fraud allegations against other political opponents, Schiff, Letizia James.
Exactly. It looks like another front in that campaign.
So the critical insight here is the erosion of norms. Threatening an independent Fed governor challenges the established checks and balances.
And the potential chilling effect on other independent officials must be significant.
Absolutely. It raises serious questions about the integrity of federal institutions and their ability to function without direct political interference, especially an institution as crucial to the economy as the Federal Reserve. A legal fight here would be monumental.
Now for another really quite startling move involving the government and private enterprise. Trump says Intel CEO has agreed to give U.S. government 10% of company.
A 10% stake in Intel for the government. How did that happen?
President Trump announced it, declaring the U.S. government now fully owns and controls 10% of Intel. He valued the deal at $11 billion and claimed the U.S. paid nothing for these shares.
Paid nothing? How is that possible? Is Intel confirming this?
Intel did confirm an investment, but put the value at $8.9 billion. And importantly, they said it's funded by $5.7 billion in remaining JSPSAC Act grants and $3.2 billion from the Secure Enclave National Security Program.
Ah, so it is funded by government programs, just maybe not new appropriations.
Ah.
And the stake is passive. No board seats.
Correct. The government gets a passive stake, no board representation or governance rights, according to Intel.
This feels like a significant step in Trump's economic interventionism. We saw similar deals with NVIDIA and AMD getting equity stakes for export licenses to China.
Right. This deepens that trend. And Intel has been struggling, hasn't it? Fallen behind NVIDIA and AI chips, reported a huge loss last year.
Yeah, an $18.8 billion loss in 2024. They ousted their previous CEO, and the new CEO, Tan, wasn't he controversial with investments in China? Trump wanted him gone too, initially.
He did. Called him highly conflicted. But apparently, Tan met with Trump and the president reportedly called him very good and somewhat a victim. So a turnaround there.
How are politicians reacting to the government taking an equity stake?
It's mixed. Treasury Secretary Bessent and Commerce Secretary Lutnick confirmed the administration sought the stake, but Senator Rand Paul called it a step towards socialism.
While someone like Bernie Sanders supported taxpayers getting a return on investment from things like the CHIPS Act grants.
Exactly. So it sparks this fundamental debate about economic philosophy. Is this smart industrial policy, ensuring taxpayers benefit from public investment in critical tech? Or is it government overreach, blurring the lines with private enterprise, potentially leading to political influence?
It certainly sets a precedent. We saw government stakes during the 2009 GM bailout. But this feels different, tied more directly to industrial strategy via the CHIPS Act, but in a way perhaps not originally intended.
Yeah, the question is, what does this mean for future tech policy? Will we see more deals like this, especially in strategic sectors? It's a potentially significant shift in the government-private sector relationship.
Okay, let's move to international trade. Canada drops some retaliatory tariffs in bid to restart trade talks.
Right, a potential de-escalation in the trade friction. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney announced Canada is lifting some retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods.
Which ones specifically?
Those that comply with the USMCA, the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. But crucially, they are keeping the tariffs on U.S. steel, aluminum, and autos.
Ah, so not a full withdrawal. How is Canada framing this move?
Carney called it matching a U.S. tariff exemption for some Canadian goods and an effort to jumpstart stalled negotiations for a new trade and security partnership. Basically an olive branch, but a limited one.
And the U.S. reaction?
President Trump called it nice. A White House official said it was long overdue. So a somewhat muted positive response.
This comes after significant tension, right? Canada was one of only two countries, with China, to actually retaliate against Trump's tariffs.
Yes. Trump had threatened tariffs right after his election win, citing those unsubstantiated claims about a fentanyl invasion from Canada. Mm-hmm. And Carney, who used to be a central banker, won election promising to manage Trump.
But his strategy shifted, didn't it? From aiming for zero tariffs to accepting some would likely remain.
It seems so. Trump's tariffs have hit Canadian steel, aluminum, and auto industries hard, creating a lot of uncertainty. Canada's retaliatory tariffs were strategically aimed at goods from U.S. swing states.
A classic trade war tactic. So the big question now is this a genuine de-escalation by Canada trying to find common ground? Or is it more of a concession forced by U.S. pressure?
And what does it signal to other countries dealing with U.S. tariffs?
Exactly. It reflects Carney's delicate balancing act in managing relations with the Trump administration, which surely has domestic political consequences in Canada as well. It shows how challenging these trade dynamics are under the current U.S. approach.
Back to domestic federal institutions, and this one is quite the reversal. The IRS plans to bring back workers.
It pushed out, but now needs.
Bring back workers they just got rid of. Why?
Because they're facing staffing vacancies in critical jobs. The IRS is actually planning to ask thousands of workers who took deferred resignation and early retirement offers to come back. How many people left?
Nearly 25,700 employees. That's about 25% of the IRS workforce. They left through buyouts, resignations, firings. It was part of that sweeping effort to cull the federal workforce under the Trump administration.
25%. That's a massive cut. Did anyone warn about this?
Yes. The IRS's own independent watchdog warned back in June that these staffing losses could create significant risks for next year's tax filing season.
So the chickens are coming home to roost, so to speak.
It seems so. And this comes after a really turbulent period at the IRS, multiple leadership changes, the seventh commissioner just this year, recent ousters of senior executives.
It sounds chaotic. What's the Treasury Department saying?
They stated a commitment to ensuring the agency is staffed appropriately to serve the American people effectively and efficiently under Trump's agenda, which sounds a bit like backtracking now.
And this isn't unique to the IRS, is it? Other agencies trying to rehire.
The article mentions the Agriculture Department and the National Nuclear Security Administration have also sought to rehire workers after facing critical staffing shortages.
This really highlights the difficulty of managing a huge federal workforce. Rapid, politically driven cuts can have severe operational consequences.
It creates this tension between the political goal of reducing the federal workforce and the practical need for experienced people in crucial roles like processing taxes.
And the direct impact is potentially on you, the taxpayer. Longer waits, processing delays, maybe issues with compliance. It shows how seemingly abstract decisions about federal staffing can affect everyday services. It's a tough lesson in balancing efficiency claims with the need for expertise.
Okay, our final item in this segment is a major shakeup in national security leadership. Hegseth fires, head of Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Jeffrey Kruse.
The DIA director fired. Why?
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth cited loss of confidence, but the article frames it as part of a wider purge of senior military and intelligence officers.
A purge? That sounds dramatic. Is there context for Kruse's firing specifically?
Yes, and it's significant. His dismissal came right after a preliminary DIA assessment contradicted President Trump's claims about Iran's nuclear program. Trump claimed he'd obliterated it.
But the DIA assessment said the setback was only a matter of months. A huge difference.
A huge difference. And this fits a pattern. The article lists others removed. the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, chief of naval operations, commandant of the Coast Guard, Air Force vice chief of staff.
Wow. And in intelligence, too.
Yes. The head of the NSA, General Timothy Ha, and the acting chair of the National Intelligence Council, who had contradicted Trump's rationale for deporting Venezuelans under the Alien Enemies Act.
So a pattern of removing officials whose assessments or actions didn't align with the administration's narrative or policies. How are people reacting on Capitol Hill?
Senator Mark Warner called it unsurprising, but condemned the removal of honest, fact-based analysis. Representative Jim Himes warned it creates an atmosphere of fear that chills the ability of the intelligence community to do its job.
That's the core issue, isn't it? The importance of apolitical intelligence. National security decisions need to be based on objective facts, not political convenience.
An administration official apparently indicated Cruz was a target because DIA and NSA were seen as closely aligned, while a military official praised Cruz's transparency under pressure.
This widespread removal of senior leaders raises serious questions about the independence, morale, and ultimately the effectiveness of the U.S. military and intelligence communities.
It seems to demonstrate a direct conflict between intelligence analysis and a desired political narrative.
And the long-term danger of that dynamic is immense. If intelligence is tailored to fit politics, it can lead to disastrous policy decisions based on flawed information. This erosion of independence is deeply concerning for national security.
All right, let's bring our focus now directly onto Washington, D.C. itself. The capital city is increasingly under federal scrutiny and, well, seems to be a capital in flux. #TechShakeShakeA. The federal takeover of D.C. law enforcement. First story highlights turmoil within the city's own police force. Under tightening federal grip, officers say their chief is absent. D.C. Police Chief Pamela A. Smith is getting criticism from her own rank and file.
Absent during the federal takeover, what are they saying?
They perceive her as being absent and alienating staff during the second week of the White House asserting federal control over the MPD, the Metropolitan Police Department. There was apparently confusion when she was joined at a meeting by White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller and the DEA head, Terry Cole. Officers weren't sure who, if anyone, was in charge.
A muddled chain of command. That's never good for morale or effectiveness, especially during a crisis or major transition.
And the article notes that even before the federal intervention, Chief Smith faced criticism for allegedly berating staff and making retaliatory transfers of high-ranking officials, though some officers sympathized with the difficulty of her position.
It's a tough spot, leading a local police force suddenly under direct federal control. How is the mayor responding?
Mayor Muriel Bowser defended Smith, calling her a solid leader engaged around the clock. Smith herself denied being disengaged, pointing to attending U.S. Park Police roll calls.
This whole situation is complicated by D.C.'s unique governance structure, right? That constant tension between local control and federal oversight.
Absolutely. And adding fuel to the fire, the Justice Department has started investigating whether the MPD manipulated crime data to make it look lower.
Which is incredibly serious, especially if that data was part of the justification for the federal intervention in the first place.
Right. It creates this huge credibility issue. And officers were also apparently confused when Smith changed a policy without explanation that previously stopped DC police from assisting with immigration enforcement.
So policy changes, leadership questions, data integrity concerns, and federal oversight all happening at once. It's a pressure cooker.
It really is. Smith was the first Black woman to lead the D.C. police, tapped by Bowser during a historic spike in violence. Now she's navigating this unprecedented federal intervention.
The critical point here is the impact on the ground. How does this affect the officers trying to do their jobs? What does it mean for law enforcement effectiveness and community trust in a city already facing complex challenges? The leadership vacuum, real or perceived, combined with the data questions, is deeply problematic.
And adding a very visible layer to this federal presence, Hegseth authorizes National Guard to carry weapons in D.C. deployment.
So the National Guard troops patrolling D.C. streets will now be armed?
Yes, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth formally authorized them, the Guard members deployed from D.C. and six other states to carry their service-issued weapons while on mission.
How many troops are we talking about?
As of Friday, the article says 2,282 Guard members were deployed. This follows Trump declaring that crime emergency back on August 11th, ordering the D.C. Guard to patrol and asserting control over the D.C. police.
And Trump's been quite vocal about this deployment.
Very. Boasting about its unbelievable success, falsely claiming the first murder-free week in memory, and he directly threatened Mayor Bowser, saying she better get her act straight or she won't be mayor very long. He even previewed expanding this model to Chicago and New York.
Wow. And the weapons, wasn't there conflicting information about whether they'd be armed?
There was. Earlier, military officials said troops would not carry firearms but have them nearby. Then the army said body armor, but no firearms. This new authorization seems to provide clear legal cover now. They're likely handguns, not rifles, but it's unclear if they'll be loaded.
This raises major questions about deploying armed military personnel on domestic soil, even if the National Guard has a different legal status than active duty military under posse comitatus.
Mm-hmm. Local DC officials are strongly opposed, calling the military presence unnecessary. A Post-Shar school poll found 80% of residents opposed Trump's takeover.
And Mayor Bowser insists D.C. can handle public safety without an armed militia. There was even a reader letter drawing a parallel to the Kent State shooting.
Yes, invoking that historical tragedy. It highlights the deep concerns about militarization and civil liberties. Trump also talked about a $2 billion capital makeover plan, though later walked it back, saying, we want to make this absolutely perfect. It's our capital.
So the critical issue is that balance between perceived public safety needs, however contested the data, and the potential chilling effect, the civil liberties concerns, of having armed soldiers patrolling a major American city.
And for D.C. specifically, with its limited home rule, it's another significant erosion of local democratic control by the federal government. It's a powerful assertion of federal authority over the Capitol.
Okay, and this federal push extends into the courtroom as well. Pirro tells prosecutors to seek maximum charges in D.C. arrests.
That's Jeanine Pirro, the U.S. attorney for D.C., appointed by Trump, former Fox News host. She's instructed her prosecutors to seek the most serious charges available for everyone arrested during this crime crackdown.
Maximum charges for all arrests. What does that mean in practice?
It means cases that might normally be dismissed, what prosecutors call no-papered, because they're trivial or hard to prove, are now being processed. The result? Crowded courtrooms, longer arraignment processes.
So it's clogging the system. Pirro has been a visible face of this crackdown, right? Pushing for changes to local laws, especially regarding juveniles.
Yes. She views D.C.'s laws as too lenient. The White House has been touting the arrest numbers, more than 450 arrests in just 1 week in early August.
But there's an interesting contradiction mentioned in the article regarding her directives.
There is. While pushing maximum charges generally and previously instituting immigration checks for all defendants, she also directed prosecutors not to charge felony offenses for carrying shotguns or rifles.
Why not?
Citing Supreme Court rulings on gun rights that she believes conflict with local D.C. law.
So maximum charges for some things, but leniency on certain gun charges. That seems selective.
It does. This whole approach impacts the idea of prosecutorial discretion. The traditional power prosecutors have to decide which cases to pursue and how seriously. Taking that away puts immense strain on courts, public defenders, everyone.
And what are the potential consequences? Higher incarceration rates?
Yeah.
Fewer plea bargains? Questions about fairness?
All of the above seem likely. The directive could disproportionately affect those arrested for minor offenses. And the inconsistency tough on some crimes, easing up on specific gun charges, raises questions about equal justice under the law. Is the goal really public safety, or is it pursuing a specific political or ideological agenda through the justice system? Now let's look at a specific case that became a flashpoint. Teens charged in DOGE service staffer attack moved from youth detention facility.
Ah, the attack on Edward Korstein. That incident was used as a major justification for Trump's D.C. police takeover.
Right.
Exactly. Even though local police data showed violent crime had actually decreased since 2023, this specific high-profile attack received huge national attention and fueled the administration's narrative.
So what happened with the teens involved?
A D.C. judge ordered the two 15-year-olds charged in the attempted carjacking to be moved from a secure youth detention facility to less restrictive detention.
What does less restrictive mean in this case?
Electronic monitoring, a 24-hour curfew, and they have to attend school. The judge cited the girls' good behavior in detention, despite past truancy, and a pending case in Maryland. The boy was sent home, again with restrictions, because a youth house was too far away. He has to stay out of D.C. except for court.
How did the prosecution react? This seems to go against the tough-on-crime push.
The prosecutor from the D.C. Attorney General's office objected, having previously argued the girl was a danger and flight risk. And U.S. Attorney Pirro has publicly stated that D.C. shields violent youths from consequences.
So this highlights the tension between the principles of juvenile justice, balancing punishment, rehabilitation, public safety, and the political pressure for harsher penalties.
Judges consider individual circumstances, rehabilitation potential, but high-profile cases like this, immense pressure on them.
Right. It shows how one incident, amplified by politics, can overshadow broader trends and force a difficult debate about judicial discretion versus a more punitive approach, especially for young offenders. Should the system focus on the individual case or send a broader political message?
Now, for an opinion piece that takes a sharp historical perspective, the spirit of Old Dixie rises in D.C.
That's a provocative title. What's the core argument?
The author argues that Trump's deployment of the National Guard, the federal takeover of D.C. police, and rhetoric like Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves sending troops because Americans deserve a safe capital city, all of it evokes the spirit of Old Dixie.
How so? What's the connection being drawn?
The piece argues it's an attempt to suppress the reality of America's legacy of racial discrimination. It connects the current actions to historical parallels from the post-Civil War era, things like refusing to sell land to Black people, vagrancy laws used for control, state-sanctioned violence, Jim Crow laws.
And federal policies that created disparities.
Yes, mentioning the 1862 Homestead Act, the 1934 Federal Housing Administration policies, the GI Bill, all of which historically favored non-Black individuals and created huge race-based wealth and opportunity gaps.
So the argument is that the current federal intervention in D.C., a historically Black city, resonates with these past efforts at racial control, even if the stated justifications are about crime.
Exactly. And it points to rhetoric like Stephen Miller calling D.C. more violent than Baghdad as part of this narrative. It also criticizes local leaders like Mayor Bowser denying a takeover and Chief Smith defending working with ICE, suggesting they risk being seen as willing accomplices.
This piece really forces you to consider current events through a historical lens of systemic racism and the federal government's role in it.
The critical point is debating how these federal actions might be interpreted, especially by residents of D.C., given this history. Is the rhetoric about crime masking deeper issues or invoking racially charged tropes?
It highlights the danger of political narratives that oversimplify complex problems or use loaded imagery, potentially damaging social cohesion and obscuring the ongoing impact of historical injustices. The piece essentially says you can't just declare race irrelevant when federal actions echo these painful historical patterns.
Okay, shifting gears to a more data-driven rebuttal. A reader letter argues, D.C. restaurants aren't suffering because of Trump.
Interesting. There was an article claiming restaurants were suffering due to the federal police presence.
Yes. This letter challenges that claim directly. It focuses on the data used, specifically OpenTable reservation numbers. The original article reported a 20-31% drop in reservations during the first week of the federalization.
But the letter writer says that's misleading.
Correct. The letter argues that the comparison period was flawed. That week was being compared to the previous year's restaurant week.
Ugh. Restaurant week always inflates reservation numbers significantly. That's a classic confounding variable.
Exactly. So what happens when you adjust for that?
Well, according to the letter, when this year's restaurant week started, a week later, reservations were actually up 29% compared to the final day of last year's promotion. And looking week over week, bookings were only down about 7% during that first week of federalization.
Much less dramatic than 20-30%.
Right. This is a great illustration of why carefully analyzing data and controlling for things like seasonal events is so important.
It shows how easily data can be used, perhaps unintentionally or intentionally, to support a particular narrative.
Absolutely. The critical takeaway is the need for media consumers, for all of us, to be critical evaluators of information and statistics. Ask, what's being compared? Are there other factors at play?
Though the letter writer does acknowledge, even while refuting the restaurant claim, that there are still serious civil liberties and policing arguments against the federal takeover.
Which is important. You can debunk one specific economic claim without dismissing the broader concerns about the federal intervention itself. It separates the issues.
Next, an editorial exploring language policy in education titled A Funny Way of Promoting English.
Funny how? What's the contradiction?
The piece criticizes the Trump administration for, on the one hand, declaring English the official language of the U.S., while on the other hand, making it harder for children, especially immigrants, to actually learn English effectively.
How are they making it harder?
through several policy changes. The Education Department quietly rescinded learners, or ELLs. They laid off almost everyone in the Office of English Language Acquisition.
Wow, almost everyone.
Yes, and they proposed zeroing out $890 million in federal funding for ELL programs and released school districts from monitoring requirements for these students.
What's the administration's rationale for cutting these programs?
They claim English language learning programs are ineffective, pointing to lower reading scores among ELL students.
But does research back that up?
No, the editorial states that research consistently shows these programs are effective, particularly for improving writing skills. The administration also argues that states are best equipped to educate EL students, essentially shifting responsibility.
But schools receiving federal funds have legal obligations to serve non-proficient English speakers, right?
Yeah.
Under the Civil Rights Act and court rulings.
Correct. The 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1974 Equal Educational Opportunities Act, and Supreme Court precedent all require schools to address language barriers to provide meaningful education. And we're talking about a significant number of students, over 5 million, about 10% of public school kids.
So Trump argues making English official promotes unity and efficiency.
But the administration's actions seem to directly undermine the ability of immigrant children to achieve English proficiency and integrate.
It's a stark contradiction. You can't really promote English by dismantling the systems that teach it effectively. This raises serious questions about the true goal of the policy. Is it about unity, or is it more related to a stance on immigration itself?
And the potential impact on education equity is huge, especially if states facing budget cuts scale back services without federal support or oversight. It could set these kids back significantly.
Finally, in this segment, a look at DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs coming under fire. Agency faults George Mason on DEI. Howard University President Ben Vinson III to depart.
Two separate but related developments. First, the Education Department has deemed George Mason University's DEI policies unlawful.
Unlawful. What specifically, and what are they asking GMU to do?
The specifics aren't fully detailed in the summary, but they've requested an apology from GMU's president, Gregory Washington. This is despite GMU having already eliminated practices like using diversity statements in hiring and promotions.
So GMU had already made changes, but the Ed Department still found fault. Interesting.
Yes, and GMU's Faculty Senate had actually praised President Washington for upholding diversity within legal frameworks.
Okay, and the Howard University news. President Ben Vinson III is stepping down.
Correct. After just 2 years, Vinson had been credited with some significant achievements, stabilizing finances, boosting recruitment of Black and Latino students, attracting high-profile scholars like Nicole Hannah-Jones and Ibram X. Kendi.
So his departure seems notable, especially now.
Definitely. Both of these events are happening within this broader context of the Trump administration investigating and pushing back against DEI programs in higher education across the country. It reflects a national trend. Howard's interim president steps into what the article calls a heated environment.
This really puts the spotlight on the legal battles surrounding DEI, especially after recent court rulings and these administrative actions.
And it raises fundamental questions about university autonomy and academic freedom. How can institutions pursue diversity goals if they're facing federal scrutiny, potential loss of funding, and demands for apologies?
It creates a climate of uncertainty, potentially fear, for universities trying to navigate these issues. What does this mean for the future of DEI efforts nationwide and for the leadership stability in institutions like GMU and especially historic ones like Howard? It's a critical moment for higher education and its commitment to diversity.
All right, let's shift our focus now to the global stage. We're seeing some really profound shifts related to migration, ongoing conflicts, and significant cultural transformations. #A, global migration and national identity. First, a disturbing trend highlighted in the Post. On migration, Greece takes a Trumpian turn. Greece, which is a key entry point into the European Union, is apparently adopting what the article calls one of the most radical plans in Europe to stop unauthorized migration.
And this is explicitly influenced by Trump's policies in the U.S.
The article suggests a strong influence. These new norms in Greece include things like lengthy incarceration of irregular migrants, mentioning a facility called Amygdaliza, dubbed an Agent Alcatraz.
Lengthy incarceration. You know, what else?
A 3-month suspension of the right to seek asylum, which could potentially be extended. And treating migrants rescued at sea like criminals.
Suspending the right to asylum. That seems like a direct challenge to international law, the Geneva Conventions.
It does. And the consequences for migrants are severe. If their application is rejected and the rejection rate is over 50%, they face voluntary deportation or potential jail time, 2 to 5 years, and hefty fines up to 10,000 euros.
Migrants from places like Yemen and Sudan, quoted in the article, expressed dismay, having risked their lives only to find they couldn't even claim asylum.
How is Greece justifying this?
The Greek migration minister, Thanos Plivris, actually praised Trump's policy, saying it would have been very difficult for Greece to take such a hard line without the U.S. and other European countries also shifting rightward. They deny violating international law, arguing most arrivals don't qualify for asylum anyway.
This reflects a broader European trend, doesn't it? Since the 2015 refugee crisis.
Absolutely. The pendulum swung right. Even countries like Germany and the Netherlands are imposing curbs, despite accepting millions of white Christian Ukrainians, highlighting a potential disparity. The EU focus is now largely on faster repatriation.
And the idea of offshore processing is gaining traction, too.
Yes, European officials increasingly back holding migrants outside the EU, citing Italy's effort to set up detention centers in Albania, and Greece considering centers in Libya, despite major human rights concerns there.
This forces a difficult conversation about the ethical and humanitarian implications. Suspending asylum, mass detention. UNHCR and human rights groups must be raising alarms.
No doubt. It really crystallizes this Trumpian turn, the global ripple effect of U.S. immigration policies, potentially reshaping international norms around asylum and human rights, prioritizing deterrence above all else. The long-term consequences for international cooperation could be significant. Back in the U.S., a complex immigration case continues. Kilmar Abrego-Garcia set free, but ICE threatens to deport him to Uganda. Abrego-Garcia. He's the Maryland man who was illegally deported to El Salvador before, despite court orders, right?
That's him. He was recently released from jail in Tennessee, where he was awaiting trial on human smuggling charges based on court orders. But almost immediately, ICE threatened to deport him again, this time to Uganda.
Uganda. Why Uganda, and how did the administration react to his release?
The article doesn't specify the Uganda connection, but the reaction was strong. The White House and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem condemned his release, calling him a gang member and monster, and attacked activist liberal judges. Attorney General Pam Bondi had previously vowed he was not coming back.
So, very strong language from the top. What's Abrego-Garcia's story again?
He's lived in Maryland for over a decade with his wife, who is a U.S. citizen, and their three children. He was initially deported back in 2019, despite a court order forbidding removal to El Salvador because of gang threats there. The Supreme Court eventually ordered his return.
And the human smuggling charges. Mm-hmm. His lawyers contest those.
Yes, they argue it's vindictive prosecution, basically, retaliation for his previous legal challenges. They note these are his first ever criminal allegations. His wife mentioned his 2019 detention, based on a false gang allegation from a detective later fired, was deeply traumatizing.
So federal judges ordered his release this time with conditions.
Yes. GPS tracking, anger management classes, and crucially, ICE has to give 72 hours notice before attempting deportation to a third country, and weekends don't count toward that notice period.
That seems like a key protection. How are lawmakers reacting?
Democrats like Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland praised his release as upholding due process, but warned the administration would likely continue trying to undermine his rights.
This case really puts the spotlight on due process in immigration law and that concept of vindictive prosecution. It's a clear example of the judiciary acting as a check on executive power in immigration enforcement.
It's this constant tug of war between the administration's aggressive enforcement goals and the courts trying to protect individual rights based on law and precedent.
And you can't ignore the human cost, the uncertainty, the fear, the prolonged legal battles. It takes an immense toll on Abrego-Garcia and his family. It makes the abstract legal principles very concrete and personal.
Now, another administration policy impacting international visitors. U.S. demands deposits of up to $15,000 of visitors from Malawi and Zambia.
Deposits. Like a bond. For tourist visas.
Exactly. It's a pilot program. Travelers from Malawi and Zambia applying for new U.S. business or tourist visas might be required to post a reimbursable bond, $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000.
At the discretion of the consular officer, to deter people from overstaying their visas.
That's the stated reason. But look at the countries. Malawi and Zambia are among the world's poorest. Around 70% of Malawians and 64% of Zambians live on less than $2.15 a day.
So a $5,000 bond, let alone $15,000, would be completely impossible for the vast majority of people there, even if it's technically reimbursable.
Precisely. Experts quoted, like Lisa Gilman from George Mason University, called it an impossible barrier, creating more inequity and disparity, and basically signaling these people aren't welcome or wanted.
How does the State Department justify targeting these specific countries?
They say it reinforces the Trump administration's commitment to protecting America's borders, focusing on countries with high visa overstay rates. Malawi was cited at 14%, Zambia at 11% in 2023. But they also noted other factors beyond overstay rates, like screening deficiencies and foreign policy considerations.
This feels like part of a broader pattern too, doesn't it? Following earlier travel bans, considerations of adding many more countries, mostly African nations.
Yes, and the administration also signed an additional $250 visa fee for travelers from a wide range of countries recently.
So legally, visa bond programs have been used before, but the sheer amount here, applied to some of the poorest countries, seems designed to function as a barrier. It's essentially a de facto travel ban based on wealth.
It creates a stark economic inequity. People from wealthier countries face fewer hurdles than those from low-income nations, regardless of individual circumstances.
And the foreign policy implications, particularly for relations with African nations, it sends a pretty negative message about American openness and could damage diplomatic ties, reinforcing perceptions of unfair treatment based on nationality and economic status.
Let's cross the Atlantic again, this time to England, where national symbols are becoming contested. England's flag swept up in an anti-immigration wave energized by Trump.
The St. George's Cross, the red cross on a white background. How is it being used?
It's being increasingly co-opted by far-right anti-immigration groups across Britain for nationalistic purposes. The article explicitly states this trend is energized by President Donald Trump's electoral success across the Atlantic.
So a flag that's commonly used for, say, supporting the England football team is now also showing up at anti-immigrant protests.
Exactly. Demonstrations calling for closed borders, protesting housing for asylum seekers, demanding deportations. There's even a campaign called Operation Raise the Colors to hoist thousands of these flags from lampposts.
How is that campaign being received?
It's dividing opinion. Some local councils support it as patriotic, but anti-racism activists see it as a deliberate tactic to intimidate asylum seekers.
And political parties are involved.
Stephen Atkinson, a leader in the Reform Party, a right-wing populist party, explicitly links the flag campaign and his party's success to a political revolution in the West that he says started in America. He talks about defending a shared history and shared culture against high immigration.
This is happening while migration remains a top political issue in the UK, right? Small boat arrivals, etc.
Yes, over 25,000 people arrived via small boats this year, keeping migration high on the agenda. Protesters are using slogans like illegals up, safety down, and protect our women and children.
It's interesting how the meaning of a flag can shift. The article notes the St. George's Cross only became a popular English symbol, distinct from the Union Jack, relatively recently, in the 1990s, mainly through football.
Which makes its meaning perhaps more fluid, more vulnerable to being co-opted like this.
So there's a debate now about reclaiming the flag.
Yes. Nick Dutt from the Royal Society of St. George wants to take it back from extremists, trying to separate patriotism from what he calls exclusive nationalism. But Lewis Nielsen from Stand Up to Racism thinks it's a losing battle, associating the flag with colonialism and historical far-right movements.
This really shows the power of symbols and how they become battlegrounds in debates over national identity, especially in diverse societies facing pressures from populism and anti-immigrant sentiment.
And it highlights that global connection again, how political styles and successes like Trump's in the U.S. can energize and influence similar movements and tactics elsewhere, even down to the choice of symbols. Hashtag, hashtag, tag BB. Continuing conflicts and humanitarian crises. Okay, let's turn now to the harsh realities of ongoing conflicts and the humanitarian crises they fuel. First, a deeply tragic story from Ukraine. He hoped Trump's summit would bring peace. Russia killed him and his family.
Oh, no. What happened?
It's about a 16-year-old boy in Kharkiv, Artem Morozov. He apparently had hopes pinned on the recent summit between President Trump and Russian President Putin on August 15th, hoping it might bring peace.
And then?
Just 3 days after his birthday, which fell on the day of the summit, Artem and his entire family were killed. His mother, his maternal grandmother, and his little sister, Mia, who was only 1.5 years old. Five Russian drones hit their apartment building. The only survivor was his stepsister, Polina, who wasn't there by chance.
That's devastating. The timing right after the summit.
For many Ukrainians, the article says, The timing reinforced their belief that Putin remains intent on attacking civilians, regardless of any peace talks. It happened just hours before President Zelensky was due to meet Trump.
And these drones, the Iranian Shaheds, are becoming more effective.
Apparently so. Better at evading air defenses, and Russia is producing more, sending hundreds at once sometimes. The funeral scene described is heartbreaking. Mia's small casket open, the others closed because of the state of the bodies. Explosions heard even during the ceremony.
It underscores the brutal reality of this war, especially the drone attacks on civilian areas, far from any front line, and the psychological toll.
Relatives quoted just expressed exhaustion praying for peace. It really brings home the human cost behind the geopolitical headlines.
And it starkly illustrates the potential disconnect between high-level diplomacy, like summits, and the horrific reality continuing on the ground. For people like Artem's family, diplomacy didn't change their fate. It's a grim reminder of the limits of talks when one side seems determined to continue the violence.
In another grim situation, this time in Gaza, Global Monitor confirms famine in Gaza City region.
Famine officially declared by the IPC.
Yes, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, the global authority, has officially confirmed famine conditions in the Gaza City region, and it's projected to spread south to Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis within weeks.
What does famine mean in this context? What are the conditions?
The IPC defines it by specific thresholds of food insecurity, malnutrition, and mortality. The report says over 500,000 people around Gaza City face catastrophic conditions characterized by starvation, destitution, and death. It's described as Gaza's most severe deterioration since monitoring started in 2023.
The human toll must be staggering. Are there numbers on deaths from malnutrition?
At least 271 people, including 112 children, have died of malnutrition since October 2023, and 70% of those deaths occurred just in the last month. Pediatricians report unprecedented levels of severe acute malnutrition in children.
Unprecedented. The article mentions a specific child.
Yes, 7-year-old Amal Albayouk. Her weight dropped to just 22 pounds due to displacement and lack of nutritious food. She struggles to digest what little food she gets and reportedly prays, "Please, God, don't let me die until I eat chicken and fish."
Just heartbreaking. And the report might be an underestimate.
Yes, it excludes largely depopulated areas like Rafah and northern Gaza, where collecting data is too difficult, but conditions there are estimated to be as severe or worse.
What about aid? Israel imposed a siege, but then allowed some aid in.
A total siege in March, then minimal aid allowed in late May, increased volume in late July, but the report says it remains largely insufficient. And distribution is incredibly difficult. Israeli fire on crowds waiting for food, armed gangs looting trucks.
International law requires the occupying power, Israel in this case, to ensure food and medical supplies, doesn't it?
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is quoted saying exactly that. Israel has unequivocal obligations under international law. We cannot allow this situation to continue with impunity.
So the drivers are clear. Lack of food, collapse of health and sanitation systems, damaged infrastructure, disease.
It's a catastrophic combination. The critical point is the international response to this confirmed famine. How can adequate aid be delivered safely and consistently? What are the accountability mechanisms?
And remembering the individual stories, like Amal's, behind the horrifying statistics is crucial. It makes the crisis tangible and underscores the urgent need for action.
Finally, in this section, a rare admission from North Korea. Kim Jong-un acknowledges North Korean losses in Ukraine war.
He publicly acknowledged casualties. That's unusual for North Korea. How significant?
It's only the second time he's done so publicly. He hailed the soldiers' indomitable fighting spirit and noble sacrifice at a ceremony in Pyongyang. The ceremony featured 101 portraits of these martyrs.
101 portraits. But reports suggest the actual losses are much higher.
Yes. The article mentions thousands of North Korean soldiers have likely died since they first appeared on the battlefield in December. Initially, they were reportedly easily killed, moving in large groups, vulnerable to drones.
But that's changed. Ukrainian soldiers are reporting something different now.
They are. Now they say the North Korean troops seem more organized, well-trained, and better equipped. And many apparently choose to fight to the death or commit suicide rather than be captured.
That's a grim picture. And Kim's public appearance at the ceremony.
It was notable. He was shown meeting bereaved families, embracing crying children, even kneeling before the portraits of the fallen soldiers. A rare display of public vulnerability for him.
This is all happening as North Korea deepens its alliance with Russia, sending munitions as well.
Yes, large amounts of artillery shells and other munitions. Kim has pledged full support for Putin's sacred war, and South Korean intelligence suggests he might send thousands more troops.
So this rare public acknowledgement, what does it signify? Is it about shoring up domestic support despite the costs, acknowledging a sacrifice that's becoming too large to ignore?
It could be any or all of those. The critical insight is the human cost North Korea is paying for this alliance, a cost usually hidden by the regime. It also underscores the deepening ties with Russia.
And the impact on the Ukraine war itself. More organized, better equipped North Korean troops could certainly affect the dynamics on the battlefield, prolonging the conflict and increasing the brutality. It's a significant geopolitical development with tragic human consequences.
All right, let's bring it back home now and look at society, culture, and sport, seeing how they reflect these broader themes in evolving times. #A, technology, lifestyle, and social commentary. First up, AI making its way into the kitchen, and maybe family arguments. Tired of meal planning or nagging your spouse? Outsource it to a machine.
AI for household chores. Like meal planning.
Exactly. Busy parents are increasingly using AI-powered apps like one called Ollie to handle logistics, meal planning, scheduling, grocery shopping. The goal is to reduce that mental load and maybe cut down on domestic squabbles.
The mental load.
Yeah.
That unpaid, often invisible work of managing a household. Does it actually work?
Some users swear by it. The article mentions Brick Quate, a vegan mom of three who says Ollie saves her up to 5 hours a week. Another user, Courtney Johnson, credits it with improving her marriage by ending the daily what's for dinner tension.
How sophisticated are these apps? What can they do?
They tailor recipe ideas based on preferences, dietary needs, what you have on hand. They can make ingredient substitutions, adjust portions, even connect directly with grocery delivery services like Instacart. Ollie apparently has over 50,000 families using it, now with a $9.99 monthly fee.
And the future vision is home robots.
That's what Ollie's CEO predicts, by 2030, apps evolving into robots doing actual physical labor. AI experts estimate automation could cut time spent on domestic tasks by 39% within a decade, with grocery shopping being the easiest to automate.
Okay, but there have to be concerns, right? It can't all be seamless.
Definitely. Researchers like Ekaterina Hertog at Oxford warn these apps don't magically solve underlying gender inequality. Often, women just end up managing the app. It becomes another thing on their plate.
Good point. What about data privacy? You're feeding these apps a lot of personal information about eating habits, schedules.
Big concern. Apps like another one mentioned, Maple, aren't IPPO compliant, so inputting medical data isn't advised. But many users, like one named Lovell, seem to take a fatalistic approach to data privacy. The convenience outweighs the risk for them.
And dietitians worry about losing the intuitive nature of eating.
Yes, they suggest using prompts that focus on using existing ingredients, rather than letting the AI completely dictate choices to preserve that connection with food.
So the takeaway is this potential reshaping of domestic work and family dynamics. AI offers convenience, tackles the mental load, but raises issues about gender roles, data privacy, and even our relationship with basic things like food. It's a classic technology trade-off.
Okay, shifting gears radically. Animal welfare and hunting laws in the spotlight. Wyoming man accused of parading injured wolf at bar, charged with cruelty.
I remember this story caused a huge uproar. Cody Roberts ran over a wolf with a snowmobile.
Allegedly, yes. Ran it over, taped its mouth shut, took the injured animal into a bar to show it off, and then killed it later. This happened 18 months ago, but he's now been indicted on state felony animal cruelty charges.
The backlash was international, wasn't it? Sparked a real debate about hunting laws in Wyoming.
It did. And Wyoming's laws are unique. Wolves are federally protected in most of the lower 48 states. But in about 80% of Wyoming, designated a predator zone, they can be hunted year-round without a license.
That's a stark contrast to neighboring Colorado, which is actively reintroducing wolves and doesn't permit hunting them.
Right. The incident did prompt some legislative response in Wyoming. Governor Mark Gordon, a Republican, called the act heinous cruelty.
Did they change the law?
They passed a bill requiring hunters to swiftly kill injured animals. But, and this is key, resistance from the state's powerful livestock industry prevented a full ban on predator whacking, which is using vehicles to run down predators.
So a partial measure, but not a fundamental change to the predator zone rules.
This case really highlights the complex history of human-wolf interactions in the West and the different legal approaches to wildlife management.
And it forces a debate about the ethics of hunting. Where is the line between legal hunting practice and unacceptable cruelty? How is cruelty defined when it comes to wildlife?
Exactly. It exposes that deep cultural divide between conservationists, animal welfare groups, and segments of the hunting and livestock communities. The debate over Wyoming values, as lawmakers put it, is front and center.
All right. Next up, a relationship dilemma from Carolyn Hax's advice column. Brother is leaving wife of 10 years because she has let herself go.
Oof, that sounds harsh. What's the situation?
A person wrote in asking for advice. The brother plans to leave his wife of 10 years. His reason. He says she has let herself go.
And how does he define let herself go?
Apparently, it means she's gained weight and, in his view, lacks career ambition. The brother is described as being in pain and wanting to act humanely. Yeah. But he hasn't told his wife yet. He's told the letter writer, parents, friends.
Yeah.
But not his wife.
Correct. And he needs a place to stay temporarily. The letter writer clearly sees his reasons as remarkably cruel.
So what was Carolyn Hax's advice?
Hax focused on the wife, saying she deserves better than staying in a loveless marriage. She advised the letter writer to support the wife primarily while still loving the brother, though maybe not liking him much for a while. And crucially, to tell the brother firmly he must inform his wife before anyone else.
That seems like sound advice.
Yeah.
Did the column spark debate about that phrase, let herself go?
Yes. Is it just shorthand for deeper issues like divergent life goals or ambitions? Or is it fundamentally a sexist and cruel justification for ending a marriage? Axe herself notes the phrase has a long history of being weaponized against women.
This really delves into relationship psychology, doesn't it? The complexities of why marriages break down, unspoken resentments, unmet expectations.
And it highlights those societal pressures, especially on women, regarding appearance and career ambition within a relationship. Are the expectations fair? Are they evenly applied?
And the communication ethics are key, too. Discussing divorce with everyone except your spouse is deeply problematic. It underscores the need for empathy and direct, albeit difficult, conversations in relationships.
And finally, in this section, a tribute to a judge known for his kindness. Frank Caprio, judge whose kindness led to online fame, dies at 88.
Judge Caprio, from Cotton Providence, he was huge online.
Exactly. The Rhode Island Municipal Court judge became famous through his reality TV show, which showcased his compassionate approach. He passed away at 88.
What was his judicial philosophy? Why did he resonate so much?
He often gave lesser consequences to people who were clearly struggling financially or personally, offered affordable payment plans, sometimes dismissed tickets altogether, often gave words of support, even hugs. Millions followed him on social media.
Was there something specific that shaped that approach?
Yes, the article mentions a pivotal moment early in his career. His father apparently reprimanded him for not properly listening to a mother who couldn't afford parking tickets. That experience deeply affected him.
That's powerful. How are people remembering him?
Rhode Island Governor Dan McKee called him a Rhode Island treasure and a symbol of empathy on the bench, showing us what is possible when justice is tempered with humanity.
He had an interesting life before becoming a judge too, right? Worked lots of jobs.
Fruit peddler, milkman, shoe shiner, served on the Providence City Council, ran for state attorney general, then became a municipal court judge in 1985, and served until 2023.
His story really highlights the concept of judicial discretion. Judges can apply the law with a focus on individual circumstances and rehabilitation, not just rigid punishment.
And his popularity suggests that approach resonates deeply with the public, especially perhaps in contrast to the often harsh, tough-on-crime rhetoric we hear.
Absolutely. It showed the power of empathy within the justice system. And it's also interesting how reality TV and social media brought his courtroom and his philosophy to such a massive global audience, demystifying the process a bit. A remarkable legacy of kindness. #, BeArts, entertainment, and sport.
Okay. Let's wrap things up with arts, entertainment, and sports, seeing how they reflect and intersect with these broader themes. Starting at the Kennedy Center, which is hosting two very different events simultaneously.
Right. President Trump announced the Kennedy Center will host the 2026 World Cup draw this December. That's a huge international event.
Huge. Trump made an unexpected visit to announce it, saying millions of visitors will have a very easy time getting in. He even floated the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin might attend.
Putin. With Russia currently banned from international competitions and Trump's own travel ban in place, though there's an athlete exemption. That seems speculative.
Highly speculative. The World Cup itself is being jointly hosted by Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. across 16 cities. This draw determines the matchups and venues. It's also noted Trump has taken a personal interest in the Kennedy Center after the board purge and federal takeover back in February.
So a major sporting diplomatic event happening at a venue now under direct administration influence. Mm. But what's the other event happening there?
At the same time, the Kennedy Center is hosting the Tony-winning musical Parade.
Parade. The musical about Leo Frank, the Jewish man falsely accused and lynched in Georgia in the early 20th century. That's a heavy piece.
Extremely heavy. The article calls it a powerful parable of anti-Semitism and tribalism run rampant. Staging it now under these circumstances at the Kennedy Center feels jarring but defiant.
Wow. The juxtaposition is stark. A musical tackling prejudice and injustice, hosted by an institution under the control of an administration often accused of fueling division. Did the creators face pressure?
The composer vowed not to change one word despite the political climate. There's even a pre-show address included by Senator Raphael Warnock from Georgia. And pointedly, a Pentagon press secretary in Trump's administration has publicly decried Frank's posthumous pardon using discredited claims.
This really highlights the complex role of cultural institutions. They host global spectacles like the World Cup draw, but also vital critical artistic works like Parade.
So the key question becomes, what happens when politics and art collide so directly within these spaces? How does political influence affect the programming, the reception, the very message of the art?
It showcases the soft power of both sports diplomacy and challenging theater. Both can serve as platforms for very different narratives about the nation and its values, creating a fascinating tension right there at the Kennedy Center.
Moving from the stage to the screen, a celebration. This film has spirit. Yes, it does. Celebrating 25 years of Bring It On.
Bring It On, a classic. 25 years already. It holds up surprisingly well.
It does. The article calls it the Citizen Kane of cheerleader movies. Maybe jokingly, but also seriously. An intro to critical race theory in a pleated skirt with pom-poms.
That's quite a claim. Why?
Because it was one of the first mainstream films to portray cheerleading as a legitimate, demanding sport. Not just sideline decoration or eye candy, it validated a generation of teen girls involved in cheer.
And the critical race theory part.
It subtly tackled cultural appropriation through its main plot. The predominantly white, affluent squad, the Toros, discovers their championship-winning routines were stolen from a predominantly black inner-city squad, the Clovers.
Right. And the Clovers ultimately win nationals on their own merit.
Yep.
It was pretty progressive for a 2000 teen comedy.
Very. And despite numerous, mostly forgettable direct-to-video sequels and a Broadway musical that didn't quite capture the magic, the original film remains incredibly popular. Cheerleaders still quote it today.
It apparently even predicted some of the most intense rivalries in real-life competitive cheerleading, which has evolved massively since 2000.
Yeah, the article notes stunts are bigger and more dangerous. Routines feature death-defying acrobatics and Olympic-level tumbling. It's a whole different level now.
So the takeaway is the film's surprising cultural significance and longevity. It managed to embed social commentary within a fun mainstream package.
It speaks to how pop culture can sometimes address complex issues in accessible ways, and why nostalgia keeps certain films relevant. They captured a moment, but also had something lasting to say about fairness and recognition. Now, let's look at a global cinema phenomenon. Chinese animated smash dazzles as its plot baffles. This is about Ne Zha 2.
Ne Zha 2. I've heard about this. Didn't it make an astronomical amount of money?
Astronomical. It's become the highest grossing animated and non-English language film in history. Global take around $2
billion. $2 billion. That's massive. Is it getting a wider release now?
Yes. After a limited U.S. run with subtitles, a newly dubbed English version is getting a wide rollout, hoping to capture more of the U.S. market.
But the headline says the plot baffles. What's the issue?
It adapts a very complex 16th century Chinese novel, The Investiture of the Gods. The reviewer found the plot opaque and confounding for audiences who aren't familiar with the mythology. Apparently, new characters pop up very late in its 143-minute runtime.
So, narratively challenging for Western audiences unfamiliar with the source material.
Mm-hmm.
But visually?
Visually stunning, according to the review. Character and environment designs are otherworldly in their originality, and the digital oceans are astonishingly lifelike.
So, spectacle over straightforward narrative, perhaps. Does anything translate universally?
Apparently, some scatological humor landed well with family audiences, suggesting some elements cross cultural boundaries. And Michelle Yeoh voices Ne Zha's human mother for a few minutes.
This really speaks to the growing global influence of non-Western cinema, especially animation. Hollywood doesn't have a monopoly on blockbuster success anymore.
But it also highlights the challenge of cultural translation. How do you take a story deeply rooted in one specific mythology and make it accessible, narratively coherent, for a global audience?
It raises questions about storytelling preferences. Do different cultures prioritize visual spectacle versus narrative clarity differently? The massive success of Nezaz 2 suggests visual power can overcome narrative complexity for many viewers, even if critics find it baffling. It's a fascinating case study in global cinema trends.
Turning to the world of youth sports, schooled in athletics, the rise of high school sports academies.
Sports academies instead of regular high school. Is this becoming common?
Increasingly so, yes. These academies are proliferating across the DC area and nationwide. They offer intensive, specialized training for students aiming for college athletics.
This used to be just for the super elite, right? Like IMG Academy.
Exactly. IMG had 281 college-bound athletes in its 2025 class alone. But now, similar academies are popping up in various forms, often made more accessible because students can do their academic work online.
What's driving this growth? Is it the changes in college sports, NIL deals?
That seems to be a major factor. The whole landscape of college athletics is changing. NIL, name, image, and likeness deals, potential revenue sharing. It's professionalizing the path to college for aspiring athletes. They're seeking scholarships, maybe compensation, and these academies promise to get them college ready.
How do they do that? What's the model?
They often mimic college formats, focusing heavily on skill development with in-house personal training. Academics are frequently handled through online curriculums that students work through at their own pace.
But what about the academic side? Are there concerns about the quality of online education for teenagers?
Yes. Education professor Christian Zenkoff from George Mason is quoted warning that online education generally yields less favorable results than traditional classrooms for young people. He acknowledges that balancing athletics and academics can be a win-win if there's enough support.
But he notes, the majority of the young people in those situations don't have that extra support.
Right. So the critical issue is this trend towards early specialization and the professionalization of youth sports. What are the educational trade-offs?
Are these academies truly preparing students holistically, or are they prioritizing athletic development at the expense of academic rigor and broader social development?
And does this trend create more inequality? Is it essentially creating a separate, privileged pathway for those who can afford these specialized academies, potentially widening the gap in both sports and education? It's a significant shift in how young athletes navigate their path to college.
And in the pro leagues, a focus on behavior. NFL plans to crack down on players' inappropriate celebrations.
The No Fun League strikes back. Or just drawing a line.
Maybe a bit of both. The NFL is making sportsmanship and illegal celebrations by players a point of emphasis for officials this season. They're cracking down on what they deem inappropriate areas.
What kind of celebrations are being targeted?
Specifically, violent gestures simulating shooting, throat slashing, and also unfortunate sexual gestures. Taunting aimed directly at opponents is also a focus. And the penalty?
A 15-yard penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct.
Is this because these kinds of celebrations are increasing?
Apparently so. Walt Anderson, an NFL officiating rules analyst, noted a 55% increase in taunting incidents last year and a whopping 133% increase in unsportsmanlike gestures.
Wow, that's a big jump. This comes after the NFL actually loosened rules on celebrations a few years ago to try and shed that no-fun league image.
Right. So now they seem to be recalibrating, drawing a new line about the nature and intent of celebrations, particularly those seen as violent, sexually suggestive, or directly taunting opponents.
This brings up that perennial debate in sports.
Yeah.
Player expression versus league control. Where's the balance?
The league clearly wants to protect its brand image, satisfy fans, some of whom dislike excessive celebrations, and maybe promote respect among players.
But players argue celebrations are part of the game's emotion and entertainment value. The challenge is always defining inappropriate. It can be subjective.
Exactly. Consistently defining and enforcing that line across different types of gestures and taunts, and considering how diverse audiences perceive them, is really tricky. It will be interesting to see how strictly this is enforced this season.
Okay, let's quickly wrap up with some Washington sports updates. A snapshot of the local teams.
What's happening with the Nationals? A dramatic win against the Phillies. They pulled off an unfathomable two-run rally in the ninth inning against the Phillies' top closer, Jahan Duran, to win 5-4.
Wow. Who are the heroes?
Rookies. Dylan Cruz hit a double, and Dalen Leal got a single, ran aggressively, and scored the tying run. Leal then scored the winning run on a throwing error. PJ Pullin got his first win as a National. Great win for the Nats. Anything else. They're also experimenting with moving second baseman Luis Garcia Jr. to first base to improve roster flexibility. He's hitting okay, but struggles defensively at second. He seems willing, saying playing other positions makes you better.
Smart move, potentially. How about the Commanders?
Big news there. They traded starting running back Brian Robinson Jr. to the San Francisco 49ers.
Really? Why?
Seems like a shift after new talent emerged. Robinson was solid, but maybe lacked explosiveness. Guys like Chris Rodriguez and camp sensation Brandon Kroski-Merritt are stepping up. Plus, they have veteran Austin Ekeler, so reshaping the backfield. And their preseason is wrapping up. Yes, the finale against the Ravens is crucial for players on the bubble. Coach Dan Quinn is telling them to focus on performing, not counting roster spots. Key players like linebackers Jordan McGee and Javonte Jean-Baptiste are finally debuting after injuries. Josh Johnson looks set to be the third QB.
Always a tense time, those final roster cuts. And quickly, the Orioles.
Fans cheered rookie catcher Samuel Basalo, who signed a big 8-year, $67 million contract before the game. Unfortunately, the O's then lost to Houston 10-7.
Wins and losses, contracts and cuts. The usual churn of pro sports.
Exactly. These updates just give you a feel for the constant player development, roster management, and the narratives playing out for local fans. Hashtag outro.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, Lee, it really feels like several big themes emerged today from the Post. We saw that profound impact of federal actions rippling down to state and local governance. D.C. is clearly a major focal point for these clashes over executive power and ideology. Globally, the picture is incredibly complex, often tragic. Migration policies are hardening, sometimes explicitly mirroring U.S. approaches, while the human cost of conflicts in places like Ukraine and Gaza remains devastatingly high. And then there's the evolution of our own society, how technology like AI is creeping into our homes, how culture reflects and shapes debates through films like Thought It On or Parade, and how even sports are changing with professionalization and debates over conduct.
Yeah, and what really stands out to me is how interconnected everything is. You know, these aren't just separate stories. Political polarization in the U.S. influences federal institutions, which then impacts local D.C. policing, which connects to national debates about crime and race. Or a policy decision made about tariffs affects international relations, which then influences economic indicators watched by the Fed, which is also under political pressure. It's all linked.
It really underscores that the forces shaping our world, political shifts, technological leaps, global conflicts, don't operate in isolation. They interact in complex, sometimes unexpected ways.
And these forces have real consequences for everyday life, for you. Decisions made in Washington or Kyiv or Athens can affect your community, your job, how your kids are educated, the information you receive. As we've seen today, from federal interventions in local governance to global conflicts impacting individual lives, information is definitely power. But maybe it's also a mirror, reflecting our collective values, our priorities, our anxieties. So the question to leave you with is, what stands out to you about the forces shaping our world right now? Where do you see the most significant changes, the biggest challenges, or maybe even the unexpected opportunities unfolding next? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Washington Post. Stay curious, stay informed, and keep digging beyond the headlines.